Before we get to this week's episode and our special guest, some show news. Shield of the Republic will be going independent soon. We're going to have more details for our devoted listeners and viewers in the coming weeks, but in the meantime, you can subscribe to us and follow us at Shield Pod on Substack, on YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you'd like to join us for the next chapter of Shield of the Republic, please sign up. Now on to today's episode. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, Bulwark contributor. I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you doing?
I'm fine. You know, the weather here is actually nice. Our garden is overflowing with cucumbers, which have actually now assaulted our deck. I mean, they're an extremely aggressive plant. I hadn't realized. We have a wonderful guest coming on later in the show. So let me leap into jackassery, if I may.
Please.
And, you know, we've had, I think recently our jackasseries have been kind of grim. And we'll go there again because that's who we are. But I do have a kind of more lighthearted jackassery that I think is more in the spirit of some of the idiocies we have seen recently. And that is, this is an article which is actually, it was originally in The Guardian, but it's now all over the news. So there was a conference last Sunday in Brazil on AIDS and on... you know, where there's an opportunity to for the United States to provide aid. And the American delegation put up a map of Africa, which had six countries identified on it. It mentioned six countries. The problem with the map is it put all of them in the wrong place. Three of the countries, particularly egregiously. So Nigeria is shown as being in sort of more or less Central Africa and being totally landlocked, which it is not. Mozambique has migrated from southeastern Africa to the Horn of Africa, which will, you know, probably be surprising to the folks in Djibouti. And my all-time favorite, the Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, is shown as being on the eastern side of Africa, when actually it's on the western side of Africa. And this strikes me as genuine jackassery. So I want to put that out there. I had two other things I was going to mention in this vein. One, which I was, before I came across this stupid map, I was going to talk about. There's a very disturbing article by Greg Jaffe about the promotion of the current chief of naval operations. I think it's Admiral Cottle. It's in the New York Times. We'll put a link in the show notes. But the gist of it is basically he's making the case that there was a serious and problematic case of politicking, and that includes really doing things which go over into sort of the areas of domestic politics. And I think there's a larger issue here which has to do with the politicization of the senior officer corps. But then there were two other things I was going to mention. One is, I think, you know, a major piece of jackassery should go to the Iranians because, you know, they've been given a win by the Trump administration in the form of that MOU. And instead, they're blowing it by doing things like launching surprise attacks at American air bases. And as we now know, attacking water systems in places like Minnesota. These guys do not know how to accept a win, and they get some kind of award for that. So I think we're in a world where we're not the only ones screwing things up. I was going to do one other thing though, which is every now and then I think I promised you I'd throw down a Trump card when I think the administration has done something good. And the administration is about to do something very, very good. They are about to get rid of the people movers at Dulles Airport. These are these stupid stupid, frustrating mobile lounges that you need to get from one course to concourse to another.
That everybody hates.
They're going to put in new concourses. Yes, it's going to be all in gold. And yes, it's going to cost $22 billion. But if Donald Trump was standing in front of me, I'd kind of rumple his hair and say, God bless you, Donald. You're finally doing something right.
I yield to no one in my loathing of the people movers. But I mean, really, is that what the president of the United States has in his job jar right now? I mean, is that what he's anyway? I take your point. So I was, thinking about having as my jackassery the foolishness that the Pentagon went through with changing up the numbers on casualties. Apparently, I mean, on the specious argument that Epic Fury ended with the ceasefire and therefore anyone killed after the ceasefire doesn't count. Some of this, I've seen speculation that some of this is driven by his desire to keep the number of casualties below those of the Afghan withdrawal by Joe Biden. Anyway, it's they've now apparently reinstated the numbers, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that. And besides, yesterday, true to form, a even greater jackassery came up. And so my jackassery goes to, Senators Rand Paul, Josh Hawley, and Bernie Moreno, with an honorable exception for Senator James Lankford, who declined to participate in a sort of auto de fe hearing that they held with Anthony Fauci, for whom I have a pretty high regard. They published 1,000 pages of Fauci's, quote, diary. I'm not sure it's his diary, actually, but it seems to be private notes that he took for himself during the COVID crisis that he kept, I guess, on a government computer, which is how they got a hold of it. I can't say I've read the full thousand pages that were posted. I have dipped into it, however, and I think number one, Senator Paul is clearly cherry picking a lot of the stuff that he has, not putting it in context of people trying to wrestle with a new virus that nobody knew very much about, people trying to get new evidence, and the various signs of vanity that appear in it. It's clear that Fauci was very taken by his, newfound prominence and the degree to which he was getting a lot of public attention, including from celebrities. But I have to say, if we're going to criminalize vanity, I think all 100 United States senators would be behind bars now.
Yeah, well, I take that point. You're right. I mean, and there's something sort of barbaric about this bullying of a guy in his mid-80s who whatever else you think about him, has served the country well and served the cause of public health well. I would qualify it, though, in a couple of ways. The vanity's actually been on display for a very long time. I mean, Fauci always had a reputation of lunging for the television cameras. There are some ways in which the things that are in the diary are at variance with things that he said publicly. For example, that he was taking a position on closing schools. I mean, he says, yeah, I've persuaded Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, to close schools, when he had said he wasn't doing that. It's not edifying when somebody like that has to take the Fifth Amendment, 90 times? I mean, I understand why he's doing it. I don't blame him for it, but it's pretty sad. And I think the larger point here, and this is, I think, you and I don't usually deal with public health issues, but it is germane here in that this is now the quintessential case of the political class and to some extent the American people profoundly losing trust in the expert class. I mean, Fauci in his area is clearly the expert. And that is not simply because they're all a bunch of yahoos. It has to do with the degree of certainty that people express, which they should not have expressed. And I think it also boils over, or spills over rather, into our field. you know, it's why people don't, I think, have a whole lot of respect for professional diplomats, professional intelligence officers. And although that's misplaced and it's unfair in many ways, it is also in part a result of the way the professional class has conducted itself and articulated its positions to a larger public. So I think it's there should be some cause for reflection there as well.
Yeah, I mean, your Atlantic colleague, Tom Nichols, has actually written a whole book about this, about the death of expertise and the hostility that exists in increasingly in American society to expertise. I mean, so I take that point. On the issue of taking the fifth, let me just say that the bullying that Senator Paul engaged in was appalling. Because
I agree.
And Marino in particular, because of the, you know, vulgarity in which he engaged, which, you know, I'm sure is an attempt to please the audience of one who was using his own vulgarity to talk about, you know, the Iranians on Fox News. But, you know, as a matter of law, it is not legal to infer guilt from a person who is potentially subject to a criminal undertaking or criminal prosecution, which is what Paul is threatening Fauci with. It is, however, permissible in civil suits to infer guilt in a civil matter when someone takes the fifth, as Donald Trump did over 400 times when he was sued by Letitia James. And yet the Republicans on the Senate committee seem to be completely oblivious to this, you know, note of hypocrisy in their own position.
You know, totally agree. John Fetterman, a senator from Pennsylvania, I thought put it best. You know, he said, look, this is just a tragedy that we can't sort of go back over our handling of this and draw some lessons without going after individuals in this way, because there are lessons. I mean, I vividly remember I was a dean back then. And so, you know, you had to follow, you're trying to follow different kinds of guidance. And while there were some public health officials who were very careful about here's what we know and here's what we don't know, there was also a kind of arrogance and a kind of certainty, which was misplaced. The arrogance and the certainty definitely came out in terms of the origins. When I remember people being completely dismissed, if you said, no, this might have gotten out of a Chinese lab, then, you know, you were a bigot. And Fauci kind of played along with that. I think the diaries do show he had more uncertainty than he exhibited on television. And, like I said, it would have just been a lot better if we could have had a sort of an honest accounting, which would have made some people uncomfortable, but without criminalizing it. Everybody was doing the best they could. But and since I don't think this is the last pandemic of this kind that we're going to face, there's a major missed opportunity, which could be quite scary in the future.
Yeah, there was a very good effort that Philip Zelikow was involved in, to examine kind of dispassionately the handling of the pandemic. And so it's not like a model doesn't exist for, you know, how to do that. It's been broadly ignored as far as I can tell. But in any event, we should probably move on because we have other subjects to cover. We had a funeral for Lindsey Graham, who we talked about last week. But it became the occasion for two pretty high-level visits to the president during the course of this. One was the meeting he had with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, and then the other with President Zelensky of Ukraine. Where do you think we are on these two issues? You know, kind of post funeral.
Well, the thing that was striking about the Netanyahu-Trump meeting is, I mean, there's clearly tension there. I think, look, most people who deal with Netanyahu decided that they despise him because he's a liar and he's manipulative. By the way, it looks like the majority of the Israeli public are there as well. But it was in both of their interests to separate themselves a bit from one another, so that they actually kept it as low profile, I think, as they could. On Zelensky, you know, this is continuing along the lines of what we've discussed, which is Trump, I think, has decided for the moment that the Russians are losers and the Ukrainians are winners. And I think that's, you know, that is gradually penetrating elsewhere. You know, we talked a little bit last week about Laura Loomer having an epiphany about Ukraine. So, you know, I think that's...
I'm just shaking my head because Eli Lake of the Free Press described her as a MAGA thought leader, which, if ever there were an oxymoron, that is
pretty much an oxymoron. The larger reflection that I have, and you might very well have others, is, you know, on the one hand, these conflicts seem very, very separate. They're different parts of the world. So not entirely. You know, the Ukrainians have struck at Russian shipments to Iran. It's clear that the Russians were providing intelligence to the Iranians. The Iranians, of course, have been providing Shahids to the Russians. And it's in a broader context of a phenomenon that maybe we should devote more time to at some point, which is that you're seeing this partnership. They're not alliances, but they are partnerships, and they're getting deeper between China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. Those relationships are getting tighter. We had two data points this past week. One is, I think there was a report that the Chinese had sent 400 man portable air defense systems to Iran. So in other words, not just sending components for manufacture, but actually weapons. And there was another report that the Russian, which is coming out of Ukraine, that the Russians have been preparing reception camps for about 30,000 North Korean troops who will go into the fight. And I think, you know, with all these things, it's not just the data point of the day or the particular events. 400 man pads may not make a huge difference. But what's the trajectory here? And the trajectory is more and more cooperation. And God only knows where it'll go. I mean, maybe we wake up one day and the North Koreans have given a nuclear weapon to the Iranians. Inconceivable.
Well, actually, before we came on, I saw some indication that one of the missiles that the Russians had fired at Ukraine was a North Korean missile.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised by that.
Which, I mean, it's not confirmed, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, when the Ukrainians hit the ship in the Caspian, I mean, there was a discussion with the Iranians. Right, the Iranians talked about retaliating, which would, you know, start to link these two conflicts together if we start getting into that.
Right, talking about hitting Ukraine with missiles.
Tit for tat. The Ukrainians said, don't do that because, you know, we're actually, this is a Russian thing we're after. It's not you per se. This is all, you're right, you know, becoming a tightening sort of set of alliances. And my sense is that although people understand this kind of alignment, this access of adversaries or upheaval, whatever you want to call it, there've been any number of articles in Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy about it. We drew attention to it in the National Defense Strategy Commission 2 years ago. I don't think the kind of operational consequences have really penetrated to people's thinking yet. I don't think they, you know, are really thinking through where this could go and how we need to think about it strategically in terms of how the U.S. acts in the world players.
I think that's right. Could I draw you out a little bit just to react to my comment about the Ukrainians possibly overplaying their hand?
The Iranians, you mean?
The Iranians, yes. I'm sorry.
Yes, but before we go there, I just want to make one other observation here. the president's been asked about, you know, the man pads from China to Iran and the Russian, alleged Russian provision of intelligence data to the Iranians that's allowed them to target U.S. forces. And in both instances, he has said repeatedly, I've been assured by Putin and Xi that they're not going to do this. He's put a Truth Social post out about this, and I take them at their word. Now, at one level, you can say he's putting that out there publicly kind of as a signal to them, you know, not to get involved. But when he was asked very directly about Xi and the man pads, he said, well, that would be surprising because Xi told me something different. But these things happen, you know. So yeah. It kind of signaled a kind of pretty passive response.
Well, I think it's probably basically because he is feckless and he does, you know, trust other tough guys, quote unquote. But I think it's what you're also likely to be getting here is we don't want to think about the implications for us and for a broader set of strategic relationships and strategic problems if we acknowledge what's happening. And that's not something that's entirely unique to the Trump administration. I mean, you and I both spent a lot of time thinking about what the Iranians were doing to us in Iraq. And it was very striking to me at the time, and it remains striking to me that, you know, a lot of people just said, I don't see any Iranian agents here. And they were all over the place. And yep. We just would rather not think about it because then the problem gets infinitely more complicated if you accept reality for what it is. That goes to an even deeper point, which I've
often. I mean, look, the Clinton administration, to your point, the Clinton administration basically blinked away all the evidence that the Iranians were behind the Khobar Towers bombing.
Right. So, and I guess, I think this gets to an even deeper point about the nature of statecraft. The government work is often a world where people say, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions, blah, 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 blah. Sometimes, I've certainly always felt this was my role, whether I was in or out of government, say, I may have no solutions, but this is reality. And I think frequently in government, what people are trying to do is escape or avoid looking at really unpleasant realities in the hope that they will diminish, go away, be dealt with by somebody else. And it's why a free press is vital, but it's also why it's vital to have people in government at the time who are going to say, boss, you may not like to hear this, but here's the ground truth as far as I can figure it out.
You know, I quite agree. And yes, and Donald Trump is not the only president to think his personal relationships, to make a bad pun, Trump, you know, the reality or what the intelligence community is telling them, you know, about the intentions or actions of another leader. On the Iranians being unwilling to take yes for an answer. So I largely agree with that. There was a Wall Street Journal article, Michael Gordon, some other colleagues yesterday, about the president has been weighing two different options, one including a kind of massive bombing campaign that the CENTCOM commander Brad Cooper has put to him as an option. Apparently, General Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is much more reserved about this, not necessarily agreeing with an escalation option. You hear a lot of comments leaked to the press from people around the president saying he's, quote, in an escalatory mood. Some of that, I think, is meant to be, you know, to influence the Iranians to the degree that they can be influenced. And I guess, you know, if you look at Iranian behavior, you've got a president who seems to be looking for an off-ramp, and the Iranians seem bound and determined to deny him one. You know, and we talk a lot about divisions inside the Iranian regime. I might personally think that's, you know, overplayed. Bob Gates used to talk about the endless search in the U.S. government for the elusive Iranian moderates and never really finding them. I mean, I think there are obviously differences inside the Iranian leadership. I think they're largely tactical, not strategic differences. I think all Iranians agree that as a consequence of this war, they need to control the Strait of Hormuz, and that it's existential to the regime. Now, they may have differences among themselves about tactically, how do you best do that? Should you pursue, you know, more talks with the Americans on the MOU, or should you make the Americans understand that there's no way that they're going to beat you into submission, and therefore they should just accept the Iranian interpretation of Articles 4 and 5 of the 14-article MOU, which their interpretation is it allows them to control the strait. But I think what they're doing is essentially cutting off options for the president that leave him in a very difficult place, where he either appears to be caving into Iranian pressure or he escalates dramatically. Now, the problem, I think, with escalation for him, and the Wall Street Journal says he hasn't made up his mind. And yesterday's strike clearly was more of the same. If you look at what CENTCOM said about the targets, they're doing exactly the same thing they've done for the last 2 weeks, with, you know, seemingly, you know, minimal effect. I'm not saying there's no effect. They're obviously hitting targets and destroying stuff, but they haven't changed Iranian behavior yet. So where does that leave the president? If he escalates, maybe it'll drive the Iranians to the table, although there's scant evidence for that proposition. The danger, I think, is if he does this and shoots his bolt with a, you know, 2 week big bombing action, and the Iranians still are, you know, thumbing their nose at him and firing at ships in the Strait, firing at desalination plants in Kuwait, going after infrastructure in the Gulf, it's going to be a lot harder for him to walk away from this and, you know, and try and spin it as any kind of anything other than a pretty serious defeat.
I agree with that assessment. But, you know, as I think I may have said before, there's danger when we only focus on our side and not on their side. And what I suspect is going on with the Iranians is, first, they are intoxicated by success as they understand it. When people are intoxicated by success, they make stupid decisions. And I think that's what they're doing now. So I don't think their grip on reality is all that good. I'm not quite sure that I agree with you about internal divisions. I think they actually... It is a more fragmented system than anything else. But a point that you and I were discussing before the show, part of Iranian strategic culture is a very high premium on humiliation. You humiliate the enemy. I think you were the one who said, yeah, when they defeated the Emperor Valerian, the Roman Emperor Valerian, they, you know, skinned him and turned him into a footstool. And if you look at how they behaved with us during the hostage crisis or other episodes, like, I don't know if you remember, they captured a British boat crew. They go in for humiliation.
And so Jimmy Carter in the hostage negotiations.
Right. And so they're following a kind of a cultural playbook. In a way, it reminds me a little bit of it, or it's parallel to, it's not quite the same thing as, you know, what we thought of as the communist style of negotiation. If you look at, there was a Turner Joy who wrote this book about how the North Koreans and Chinese negotiated the Korean armistice. Or if you look, you know, read Kissinger on what it was like negotiating with the North Vietnamese. There's a very, very distinctive style. Now, that was partly cultural. It was probably more heavily ideological because, you know, the Russians were that way in certain respects. In this case, I think it's more deeply cultural, that you humiliate your opponent. And I don't think that's a very good thing to do with Donald Trump, because if there's, you know, you may think, and I may think, that it'll be counterproductive to throw a really big punch that might sour, but it's not clear that Donald Trump feels that way. And furthermore, I think he is perfectly capable of saying, okay, we're going to begin wiping out your power plants one by one. And or you attack a water salination plant in the Gulf, we'll attack equivalent facilities in yours, and we can do a better job of destroying it than you can. And you take it from there.
But he said similar things repeatedly since March and not executed on them. And The problem with that is that if you're sitting in Tehran, you're thinking, this guy's never going to do that because he hasn't so far. Now, I mean, I take your point, and I'm not arguing. I think they're pushing him beyond the point where it is reasonable to do. But I'm just saying, if you're sitting there, this is a guy who huffs and puffs and says he's going to blow your house down, but he doesn't do it. The other thing I would say is, I'm pretty sure that one thing that the chairman has in mind is our diminishing stocks of munitions, which is a very, very serious problem. And, you know, the Energy Information Agency reported on Wednesday that our oil stocks in the Spro are at the lowest level since we started building the Spro in the mid-1980s.
So strategic petroleum reserve, yeah.
Strategic petroleum reserve. So the margins, you know, that existed, the buffers that existed to the potential oil shock when the war started in February are pretty much gone. And the Department of Defense is running out of money. The Secretary of Defense just testified in front of Congress that, you know, earlier this week, that if they don't get a big slug of money, which at least for the moment doesn't look like it's coming, or at least in a timely fashion, they may miss payroll.
Right.
All of these things, I think, are kind of making it very hard for him to make the decision.
I agree, but that wouldn't overly, I wouldn't overestimate the extent to which he is a rational calculator who goes through things. Well, say, you know, let me look at our inventory of munitions and how much oil we have. I'm also minded of a very different kind of episode, but it's parallel in one way, which is, if you remember just before the surge in Iraq, as you should since you were there, when, you know, Bush goes to meet with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they say, well, you know, if you extend tours for a couple of months, it's going to break the force. And he says, no, what's going to break the force is losing a war.
Yep.
You know, at that level, and even with Trump, who is not George W. Bush, for whom you and I both, I think, have much more regard, a lot more regard, a politician at that level thinks differently about the sort of technocratic kinds of calculations. They may be aware of them, but they may be weighting other things more heavily. And he may, for example, he may think, look, if I really do throw a very heavy punch, it'll make everybody, including the Chinese, realize don't push me that far. But I agree with you. He would rather chicken out at a certain level, but he's dealing with people who probably are not going to let him do that.
Yeah. I mean, one other constraint, which we haven't talked about, is the Gulf allies. And I mean, in addition to the meetings with Bibi and with Zelensky this week, there was a very interesting other meeting, which was Khalid bin Salman, the defense minister and brother of the crown prince, sought an urgent meeting yesterday with Vice President Vance, in which he allegedly made a very powerful argument for de-escalation rather than escalation. Now, you know, why is that?
He knew he was talking to a guy who would agree with him.
Of course. No, I mean, obviously...
But
that's very revelatory, you know, window into what's going on, because, first of all, the Saudis have been largely spared, you know, some of the destruction that's been wreaked on other lesser Gulf allies like Kuwait, Bahrain, etc. The UAE, we learned essentially this week in news articles, one of which you flagged for me, is basically trying to hedge and, you know, manage its relationship with the Iranians. They would like de-escalation as well. But as you suggest, he went to see Vance because he sees Vance as a friend in court who will argue for de-escalation with the president and have his views taken seriously. So there's a lot of, you know, moving parts to this.
Yeah,
and we
haven't even talked about the Houthis, who the Saudis began bombing. I mean, that's why I think whenever people say, you know, we lose this war, this is too early to tell. This war is still ongoing. I mean, I'm not hopeful. I'm not optimistic. But as you say, there are a lot of moving parts. There are a lot of missiles and stuff flying around. There'll probably be more that'll be flying around. And, you know, if there's one thing we know, it's that war is unpredictable.
Yeah, I agree. Let me try out a proposition on you, and then we probably need to wrap up and get on to our terrific guest and talk about a much more uplifting subject. So look, there are, you know, several ways this could turn out. We might have this big, you know, paroxysm of escalation to try and get them to the table. We might have the president decide to de-escalate and tell us yet again that the Iranians are begging for a deal and try and get back to the MOU. My sense is where this is headed is, for, you know, kind of indeterminate outcome where we go through periods where they're talking and it's punctuated by, you know, tit for tat strikes and threats on both sides about I'm going to do this terrible thing. You know, he's going to say, I'm going to do all this terrible stuff to your infrastructure. And they're going to say, we're going to do all this terrible stuff to the Gulf infrastructure. And they're showing that they're spreading this. I mean, the drone strikes on the Egyptian natural gas or the natural gas tankers in Egypt, off Egypt is an indication of their horizontal escalation of this conflict. And that it's just going to, you know, continue, that we're going to be in this do loop of, you know, talks punctuated by violence.
I think the chances of escalation are actually higher. You know, you mentioned the attack on the Egyptians. You mentioned what I mentioned earlier, that there's a series of attack, I think, on like 34 different water plants in Minnesota. And that's probably not the end of it, by Iranian hackers getting into the control system. I think they will. I don't think you're dealing with a kind of soberly calculating opponent. I think they will escalate horizontally because they think everybody's afraid of them and can be intimidated, and because the Americans don't have any cards. And I just think that is, sooner or later, they will run into other kinds of realities, including other people joining the fight in any of a variety of ways, some of which may be very much sort of gray zone stuff. So as always, we're going to have more to talk about. But let's talk about something more exciting and uplifting, namely the Declaration of Independence.
I agree. We'll have to leave this subject there. And as the president is wont to say, we'll have to see. And now to our special guest today, Professor Robert Parkinson of Binghamton University, a specialist in the American Revolution. He's written a number of books, but on this 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, he has a new book, Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence. And I'm not going to speak for my partner in crime here, Professor Cohen, but my personal view is if our viewers want to read one book about the Declaration this year during the anniversary, this is the book to read. Professor Parkinson, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a very lovely thing to say.
So let me just quickly ask you to orient our viewers and listeners to your book in the sense that most historians of the Declaration, going back to Carl Becker and others, focus very much on the preamble to the Declaration and the, you know, very lofty thoughts expressed there, including Jefferson's line about inalienable rights and all men being created equal. You focus in a very different way, not on the preamble, but on the train of abuses that the colonists felt they had suffered at the hands of the king and parliament. You go through those in some detail. Why did you write your book that way?
Well, I do think, first of all, no one has done that. And I think in more than 120 years or something like that, I think 1907, there was an article in the Philadelphia Magazine of History and Biography that was detailing what all the grievances were about. But since then, I mean, people have talked about them, of course. You know, Pauline Mayer's wonderful study, American Scripture, has a little bit on the grievances, but no one has really made that the focus of an entire book length project. And, you know, when I was a graduate student at the University of Virginia, one of the things I got to do was I worked on the a museum exhibit that's still there at the small library at the Special Collections Library at UVA, on that he was one of the world's sort of most important collectors of Declaration stuff, and he donated all of his stuff when he gave his name to the Special Collections Library, and I happened to be the person that worked on that, and so as in writing up that exhibit and creating all of the displays for it, I did some work on what all the grievances were. And so I was sort of at the end of a third book project, and I thought, oh, maybe I'll pick that up again. And it turns out that it kind of does have some timeliness to it, in that we've been talking a lot about the grievances in 2025 and 26.
You know, it's I just agree with Eric. It's a brilliant book. It's a brilliant idea to tackle it that way. It's also wonderfully written. It's very engaging. It's a very engaging book, and I think particularly for one of the things that you come out from it with is a better sense of the crisis that leads to the revolution, beginning really in the 1760s, although possibly origins longer than that. So if you're looking not just to understand the boring bits of the Declaration of Independence, as my kids used to refer to them when we would read the Declaration aloud on July 4th, but you want a better sense of what brought us to that moment, then I really warmly recommend the book. I'll go into this a little bit more later on. I have to say, you know, I'd always thought, being a somewhat conservative person, that if I'd been around back then, I would have been a loyalist. And after reading, temperamentally, that's probably what I would have been. But I have to say, after reading the book, I said, no, I would have, you know, grabbed a fife or a drum or something like that. Because, you know, you really show the range of issues that Americans were upset about, most of which, not all of which, but most of which we can identify with actually quite easily, and which you make sense of. And you, I think, refute some of the more shallow criticisms of those grievances that were made at the time. One of the other things, and this actually is leading up to a question, that I think is one of the great strengths of the book, is Tyrants and Rogues referred to the American views of the British officials, there were some Americans, but mainly British officials, that they were dealing with. And I think one of the book's strengths is it tells us a lot about how the British Empire worked in the 1760s and 1770s, to include the importance of family connections, the importance of people trying to make money, but also the context in which they're thinking about the colonies, which include Ireland and Scotland, is, I think, shaping their mental image of how you deal with this. So I was wondering if you could expatiate a little bit on that, on British imperial culture, and to what extent, you know, in a certain way, this is just setting up a almost unavoidable, or I guess as Seward would have called, an irrepressible conflict.
Sure. I mean, the challenge that I faced in this book is just not to do the most boring thing possible, which is to just say, well, 4 is about this, and 5 is about this, and 6 is about that. I wanted to find a sort of narrative hook, and so I stumbled upon the idea of turning each grievance into a person, right? So, and thinking about creating a rogues gallery, that's really what the book is, a rogues gallery. When American patriots or American sort of population heard these grievances, who were the people that they thought about, right? So when they heard 9 or 11, they went, oh, that's Thomas Hutchinson, I hate that guy, right? Or when they heard 13, or, oh, that's George Grenville, right? So I wanted to kind of elucidate who those people were, because I think we forget about them. We forget about the long roster of people that were household names at the time, but we have lost touch with. Maybe people have heard about Thomas Gage, perhaps, or Lord North, maybe, but Hillsborough, who's brought out such incredible passion, we don't remember about. And so each grievance, each chapter sort of introduces one of these rogues. And what was so much fun to write was thinking about them as trying to humanize them in a lot of ways, right? I mean, the Patriots have this sort of very sort of villainous and almost a one-dimensional side of them. So I wanted to talk about, well, why is Francis Bernard take this? He's the governor of Massachusetts. Why does he take these stances? Well, he's broke and he has a huge family and he's trying to feed his family and he's trying to please his cousin, who's the secretary at war. And so trying to think about all of these kind of family and biography and about how a lot of the patron-client relationships work in the British Empire. you know, a lot of these guys go to school together. They're classmates. They go back to Eton or they go to Westminster School. And so thinking about how this is in many ways what, you know, Serena Zabin's fine book on the Boston Massacre talks about the revolution as a family, as a divorce, right, as a family affair. And I was thinking along those kinds of lines about the intimacy and the family nature of this and how that can talk and that can really show us why these feelings are so hard and why this is an emotional breakup in a lot of ways because of that intimacy.
You know, one of the things that I've often wondered about in some of the, my own readings, including of some of the parliamentary debates, as the British are making the decision to be really quite repressive, is you had a rather limited number of Brits who actually had direct personal contact with the colonies. Of course, George III never really left UK. I mean, he had no idea, but you had some, and while some of those were the ones who really thought this was going to end badly, there were others who were still willing to be repressive. I mean, Gage is a very good example, the British commander who launches Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill, and we know how those turned out. How well do you think those people actually knew the Americans? Because one of the impressions I come away with is that there's also this vast gulf of miscomprehension that the Brits yes. don't understand. You've created, these are new kinds of societies which simply will not tolerate things that might have been acceptable in different parts of Great Britain.
Right. I mean, I think, so this works in both directions, right? This kind of misunderstanding about where, about how these societies are changing. It's an old, sort of bone that's been gnawed over about the American Civil War. Like, who changes more, the North or the South, right? What that causes this to happen in 1861? Well, the same thing can be sort of said about the American Revolution. Who changes more? Is it the American colonies changing more or the British? And the answer is both. And they also don't understand how these things are changing. So, for example, the middle 10 grievances are about Parliament, right? Jefferson and the Congress calls it Parliament, a jurisdiction foreign to our constitutions. And what that's about is, so it doesn't even, it's foreign to our constitutions. It has absolutely no sovereignty or authority over us. It exists entirely apart from us. And that is in many ways the kind of constitutional crux of the American Revolution. Who is actually, where does authority actually going to ultimately lie? And that is a new idea in the 1760s and 70s in Britain, that Parliament is sovereign. It comes out of the sort of the civil wars of the 17th century. And then it sort of, its idea has been emerging over the 18th century. And it finally does emerge in the 1760s, the end of the Seven Years' War. And the Americans say, no, we had, when we formed colonies in the 17th century, Parliament was nothing. So we didn't come here under any idea that they were in charge of us. And so there is that kind of, that's really where that disconnect comes from. If there's no compromise on that issue, we have a real problem here. But yes, you're right. There's not a lot of people, there's not a lot of offices that the king can pay off. He can't turn George Washington into a baron. He can't pay off these guys by giving them sinecures all over the place. And American colonists are also giving the British terrible information about what's going on in America. The reason the British believe that this is a Boston problem, and if not a Boston problem, a Massachusetts problem, but no further, is because of all of the intel they're getting. Like, we think about sort of modern wars in America. Why don't we understand what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan? There's bad information. That same thing is happening in this conflict as well.
Let me ask just one other question, then hand you back over to Eric. One of the things that has always struck me, and it really comes out, I think, in your book as well, is that a lot of the British imperial officials think, well, all you really need is the firm smack of authority. You know, that leads to things like the burning of Falmouth, which I guess is now Portland, Maine. But other things along the frontier that, you know, if we just give these guys a hard smack, they'll understand what's what and fall into line. First, do you think that reading is correct? And
nope.
Okay. Say more.
Nope. No. Well, Gage says, give me four regiments and I can do the job. Four regiments is all I need. That's what he says. He says that he thinks that in 1768. He thinks that in 1774. All I need to do is control Boston and mess. And so he's on the ground in Boston still thinking that this is a Boston problem. And what the British, when we talk about sort of how these things have evolved and what the British don't understand, is how there have been some really key players. I would put Sam Adams in this group and John Adams to a little bit of a lesser extent in this group, of people who have done a lot of quiet work building communication networks and political networks between the colonies in the 1760s and 70s. Sam Adams especially is essential to creating all sorts of information networks that was going to culminate in like the committees of correspondence, where the Americans start to learn about one another and think about, well, if it happens to them, it might happen to us too. But that's not a natural response. That is something that has been worked on and worked on and worked on over the 60s and 70s. And the newspapers also come into this as well, that there's been a lot of work being done in newspapers where you have key printers also serving in the Sons of Liberty or also serving on a lot of these different committees, where they are starting to see that we need to spread these stories and get our people in Philadelphia and New York or in Virginia to understand that what happens to Boston can happen to us too. If there's a Massachusetts Government Act, there can be a South Carolina Government Act. And that is not a natural sort of organic upwelling effect. That is planned and labored over.
Yeah, but I guess just to kind of close the loop on this, you know, the sense you get is the Brits do think that they can crush this with a display of force and engage with his four regiments, Admiral Montague with the burning of Falmouth. And that seems to me, you know, it ends up being a very big mistake, not just strategically, but even tactically. I mean, Bunker Hill, what's Bunker Hill if not thinking that, you know, when you have a couple of thousand redcoats advance, that, you know, these peasants will retreat. And I suppose my question is, was that because of how they thought about the Americans, or is it because in general how they thought about dealing with somewhat inferior kinds of breeds, you know, who periodically rebel against the empire?
Yeah, it's probably a combination of both, but this has never happened on this scale before. And this is as it unfolds, the British then realize. I mean, and this is really happening in the few weeks or so before Lexington and Concord, when they start to realize, and then of course after that they realize, oh, we have a continental problem on our hands, and they've never had something along those lines before. This is the first kind of episode of what we'll call the Age of Revolutions, but there's never been a colonial rebellion over this square miles involving this many people before. And so that catches them off guard.
If
you look at the timing of when loyalists start to write and realize that they're in real hot water, when the temperature of the frog has now reached just about boiling, it's right after the First Continental Congress in the winter months of 1774-5, when they realize they have a problem on their hands, because everybody kind of just assumes this is going to go away, or they can kind of threaten their way out of it short of force. That's really sort of what they think. Or they also think that British liberty is what we're fighting over in a lot of ways. And when the Americans are trying to define liberty, I talk about this with my students, the Venn diagram between how the Americans define liberty and how the British define liberty, the differences are tiny slivers of differences between the two of them. It's just really about who is going to represent you in Congress, and where do they live? That's really the bulk of the differences. And so that's where the pressure is about how much you have to ask people to put their lives on the line for that tiny little bit of difference. The loyalists think this is probably just going to go away, and it's not going to, because of that work of getting people to understand that our way is the right way.
Yeah, I'd like to dig into this a little bit, because as I read your book, one of the things that struck me is how much of our contemporary political culture is actually still rooted in this kind of founding era. And it doesn't mean you have to be, you know, an American whose family came over on the Mayflower to do it. Americans become very, you know, immigrants become very cultured to this too. What I have in mind is first, the antipathy to taxes and to paying the salaries of these rapacious rogues who the British have put in charge. And it's extremely striking. You know, the governor is writing back saying, these sons of bitches won't pay my salary. You know,
right.
How am I supposed to live?
And
you know, how am I going to fix this? And it's going to be the heavy hand. And at the same time, you're also struck, I was struck by, you know, the violence, not just the violence of expression towards people like Francis Bernard or even more Thomas Hutchinson. And of course, Bernard Bailyn, you know, titles his famous book, The Ordeal of Thomas Hutchinson. But when you read about it, I mean, it's mobs destroying his house, breaking up his furniture,
unbuilding his house. Yes.
Unbuilding. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an incredible amount of violence. And trying to understand that, trying to put myself kind of into an 18th century mindset, which is not easy, obviously. The thing that I come back to is something that you talk about, that Bailyn and Gordon Wood, the late Gordon Wood, tragically passed this year, talk about a lot, which is the sense that colonists had that what the British were engaged in is a conspiracy against their liberties. And this is a motif that runs through American history, you know, not just in the Revolutionary era, but even up to obviously to our own day and age. But it has a special force, you know, in 18th century North America. I wonder if you just talk about that a little bit, because it seems also to be how the train of abuses, the list of grievances, very much rooted in this notion that what we're picking out here is indications of a larger effort to strip us of our liberties. And as you say, there's a kind of misprision. The British, you write very eloquently about British authors trying to respond to the Declaration and saying, this is piffle, this is nonsense, you know, none of this
or hypocrisy.
Of this is real. But for 18th century, North Americans, it was very real.
Yes. Well, I do. I mean, I think there is certainly the idea that there has to be an organizer to the way events unfold is still something that is not something. I mean, I do think this is something that people do still sort of cotton to, right? That there's got to be some sort of master plotter behind it all, right? And that's, you know, for a lot of this, you talk about the late Gordon Wood. My favorite writing of his is an article he wrote in 1982 about causality and conspiratorial thinking. Yeah,
in William and Mary Quarterly.
Yes, it's a brilliant sort of exposition of 18th century culture and how, you know, Hutchinson's Puritan forebears just saw Providence or God as the sort of orchestrator of all events. Well, they're not that far away from that. And they're looking for something. It might not be God necessarily, but there is always somebody. So they're looking for a master plotter. And so that person could be Lord Bute, who's the secret man behind King George III and pulling all of his strings. It's going to be Hutchinson. And so when Benjamin Franklin comes upon his private letters, of which Hutchinson actually does say that the Americans should have their rights abridged, he has to have them published, which is a huge violation of kind of gentlemanly code to publicize his letters. But it's the expose, right? It's exposing these things. But there's always this concern about that. I think about Grievance 3 is kind of a weird one. It says he has refused to pass other laws for the accommodations of large districts of people, unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. And that is a reference to American colonial legislatures creating new counties as the population moves west. So in New Hampshire, for example, or New York, or Pennsylvania, when the population moves west, they create new counties, and they expect that those new counties would send a representative to the capital to add to the legislature. But that's actually not their ability to do that. That's only in the king's prerogative that they can add to the legislature. But Jefferson says, what's really going on here? In his rehearsal of the Declaration, when he writes about this grievance in a pamphlet he writes in 1774 called A Summary View of the Rights of British Americans, he says, what's really going on here? Why would you want to limit the size of the legislature? Is this so they can be bought off more cheaply? So he's always looking for that. What's the layer beneath the surface here? That kind of thinking is happening over and over and over again when they think about these grievances. And for me, I think it's really, you know, when we step back from them, we think about like that kind of idea about a broader sense of representation that really is not about taxes. It's about a whole host of things. And there's a lot of how you seek justice in the empire in the grievances. There's a lot of stuff that is really sort of, thinking about would I be a loyalist or a patriot? Some of that stuff I can say, yeah, oh, I get it. Yeah, those are really, really important issues. The governor's salaries might seem trivial, but it's not. Taxation, being able to have a jury trial in your own venue. Those things are super important, and if we lost those, we would be upset too.
You know, along those lines, do you want to comment about what is the nature? You very deliberately decided I'm not going to talk about the first part, but what's the nature of the connective tissue between the grievances and we hold these truths to be self-evident, and you know that?
Oh yeah,
particularly eloquent statement by Jefferson, which still resonated so much with Lincoln and resonates with us today.
Right. So the difference is the we and the he, right? We hold these truths that we are different than he. He has, which lists 17 of the, it starts 17 of the 27 grievances, is he has particularly done this. And that in many ways is the sort of the political fault line in the Declaration of Independence, right? So we Republican citizens, we the American people who are announcing themselves for the first time, are distinct from and the opposite of and breaking away from the tyranny of he. And so that, and that really is the last thread that has to be broken. That's why there's such a motion in the Declaration. If we've already said that Parliament has nothing to do with us, then what connects us in the British Empire? It is the connection to the king. So he has promised us his protection, and we have promised him our affection and loyalty. So, but he has withdrawn that protection now, and so we owe him nothing. And so in many ways, that is the differences between the you can only understand the we if by getting rid of he.
Interesting. Let me ask one last question, Ritz. The time has really flown by. Could you talk about the grievance that got X'd out by Congress? You know, one of the great things about the book is at the end you have an appendix. Okay, here's Jefferson's original draft, and here are the parts that got edited out by and large. You know, it seems to me Congress actually did a pretty good job of tightening up Jefferson's prose since he could get quite flowery. Yeah. As they were good editors, even if he was the drafter that you wanted. But there is one particular grievance, which I think will surprise many people who are not familiar with it, which they X'd out completely. So if you could just go on a tear about that, I'd be grateful.
Well, they don't X that out completely. They do X out about all but five words of it, or all but the last concept. It is the what was intended by Jefferson to be the last grievance. He turns in 29 grievances. They cut two of them out, actually, but this is supposed to be the last one. And it is 168 words long, which is about 10% of the whole document itself. It's extraordinarily long and much longer than everything else. When John Adams makes a secret, we think probably a secret copy of the Declaration draft and sends it home to Abigail and at least one friend of his in Boston, John actually turns this into three grievances because he thinks there's no possible way this is just like one long thing. And it's in two tenses, actually. It's in the beginning of it is in the past tense, and then it turns into the present tense. Congress doesn't like the past tense, but they think it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's blaming King George III, who's only been sovereign since 1760, for the rise and growth of the Atlantic slave trade, which they think is a little bit of shaky ground. Now, Jefferson, if you asked him, do you mean George III? He would say, no, I mean the British monarchy. And if that's the case, going all the way back to the Stuarts. If that's the case, then he's right about this, that there's new books coming out. Holly Brewer has a new book coming out about how deeply ensconced the British monarchy is with the growth of the slave trade. Jefferson's right about that, but not George III. Anyway, so, but in his, as he says, he calls the slave trade waging cruel war against human nature, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty. He calls it piratical warfare. He calls it the Christian King of Great Britain. And determined to keep up in a market where men should be bought and sold. And that's the second time Jefferson uses the word men, by the way. All men are created equal. Where men should be bought and sold. That's interesting. And then he has prostituted his negative for repressing every legislative attempt to restrain it. This execrable commerce. Congress doesn't like that. And Jefferson later in his life explains why it got knocked out. And he says Southerners didn't like it, but also my Northern brethren also felt pretty anxious about it because it was blaming the slave trade. And where were those ships being made? They were made in Massachusetts. Where were those crews coming from? They were coming from Rhode Island. He's not happy that they are also not happy about being sort of implicated in this. And so they cut it out, except they don't cut out the present tense part where he says, and then he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms amongst us. And then Congress takes that sort of concept out and attaches it to another grievance where then it says he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us, which is domestics being a euphemism for enslaved people, and is now endeavored to bring on the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. And then they make that the last grievance. So instead of having this really sort of stinging, aggressive attack on the slave trade, what actually ends the declaration is an endorsement of race prejudice and putting together enslaved people who are running away for their own liberty and freedom and native peoples who are making decisions to protect themselves and putting them with he. And I think that has a lot to do with thinking about who belongs to this republic and who doesn't.
And just very last thing, what does it tell us about Jefferson, a slaveholder, wanting to end the Declaration with this furious denunciation of the slave trade? I mean, he is such a contradictory figure. I'm just curious what your take is.
Right. Well, when he says he has prostituted his negative for every attempt to restrain it, Jefferson's actually repeating himself because that's actually grievance one, too. Grievance one is about the veto. And in that pamphlet that's 2 years old, the pamphlet that kind of established his reputation as a writer, Jefferson says, here's the veto that I'm talking about. And he talks about the 1773 act passed by the House of Burgesses, which he votes for, that would tax, basically tax the slave trade out of life in Virginia. It would make it so expensive to import a human being that it wouldn't be a financially good decision anymore. And the king vetoes that. So Jefferson is repeating himself. So what does that tell us? That the grievances were supposed to begin anti-slavery and end with anti-slavery. I think that tells us something about Jefferson's thinking. He calls the abolition of slavery the great object of desire amongst the colonies in that 1774 pamphlet. But I think that what happens as a result of the early years of the Revolutionary War, where you have this mustering of race and fear to achieve a political end, where you see what actually ends the Declaration, which is this attack on enslaved domestic insurrectionists. I think that sort of alters the course in many ways of history in a lot, I would say.
And of course, the context for Jefferson's concern about the insurrectionary rhetoric of the empire is in his home state of Virginia, where Lord Dunmore, the governor, has actually put out a proclamation calling upon enslaved people to rise up and join the British army. And at the very same time he is writing this grievance that you just described so eloquently, he is following obsessively the misadventures of Governor Dunmore, who is aboard a ship with his retainers and some loyalists and a number of African Americans who have fled to Gwynn's Island, this kind of remote island off the peninsula of Virginia, where they're being laid siege by the Americans. And he's following this obsessively, which, as he wrote this, which I did not know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jefferson's not a drawer, right? He's not really much of a, I mean, he doodles a little bit, but you don't have a lot of sort of art from him. But he makes this extremely detailed sketch of the island, documenting where everybody is on the island, the fleet that is kind of protecting the British, where they're pulled up on the western side of the island, where the cannons are. And how could he have made that map if he wasn't paying extraordinary attention to every piece of information about what's happening in Gwynn's Island? And that is the last kind of episode of this months-long kind of ordeal, to use Balin's word, that Virginia has been going through with Dunmore that's lasted almost an entire year. Jefferson has this map in his papers that is really striking about Gwynn's Island, and it pops up in all sorts of ways. And that's happening in the weeks that Jefferson is writing the Declaration. In the middle weeks of June is when all this is happening. It's in the Philadelphia newspapers. He's paying a great deal of attention to this episode.
I think probably both Elliot and I could go on for hours with you, and I hope we can actually have you back, because you're extremely prolific. I'm sure you're going on to new projects. Do you have a new book project in mind now that you've completed this?
Yeah, I was thinking about doing something, taking a break and doing something like really long term. But I think I wanted I had so much fun writing this book, and I had so much fun with the Boston parts of this, because that's sort of where 10-year-old me fell in love with this, was Freedom Trail and Sam Adams and John Adams. So I've decided that I'm going to shelve that other project, and I want to get back on the horse as fast as I can. So I'm going to write a book called that I'm tentatively called Boston's Revolution, about the 15,000 people living in Boston between 1754 and 1774. And the 7,500 days that goes on between those two things, about how Boston gets into this position where a political emergency comes to your shores. How do you deal with it? And I'm going to do it through these two families of the I'm going to develop some of the stuff that I did here with the Hutchinsons and the Olivers and the Adamses and the Otises, that kind of sort of Capulet and Montague family structure in Boston. But no one's ever done kind of Boston over 20 years, but I want to try to attack that.
As a Bostonian born and bred, I can't wait.
That was my thing. We lived when I was a child, we lived halfway between Plymouth Rock and Lexington Green, and my job was to get my mother to take me one of those two places.
Of course.
Every weekend.
Of course.
She did well. We'll definitely have you back. And thank you so much, Professor Parkinson, for sharing this time with us and for writing this terrific book about the Declaration.
Oh, thanks, guys. It was great to talk to you.